Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks UK, I think, mostly for this one. But it will apply to the USA as well, because I'm going to be looking at the concept of democracy and asking, is democracy in trouble? It's kind of an introduction for the A-level course, but it's going to introduce some ideas that will be of fundamental importance across all aspects of politics. And with so much in the news at the moment about democracy and democracy being attacked, that it's important to be able to get some of the principles around here. So is it in trouble? Well, let's have a little bit of a history lesson here and think about what democracy is. It is a Greek term. It's almost line one of a textbook, but hey-ho. Demos means the people in Greek, and kritia or kritia, my Greek's not brilliant, means power or rule. So demokratia becomes democracy, and it means rule by the people. Literally, the power or rule of the people. In essence, it's the ordinary people run the state. Yeah, what a lovely idea. But in ancient Greece, this concept, it wasn't really understood in the way that we understand democracy. So the first existence of what we would recognise as a democratic system comes from ancient Athens in the form of direct democracy. Now, this is where citizens, and that's a key word, citizens, which basically meant men who paid taxes, they would meet and vote directly on an issue. So an issue would be proposed, they'd all vote, yes, we'll do this, or no, we won't do that. So proposals made, people vote on the proposal or they vote against it, and the majority won. What we call a majoritarian democracy. Very simple, very straightforward, and that meant the citizens decided directly on what would happen. Therefore, direct democracy. However, in the ancient world, and it's worth bearing in mind that although Athens adopted it and a couple of other states, it didn't last particularly long, and democracy itself was seen as a kind of an insult. And the word democracy, we'd probably recognise as more like anarchy and chaos, that ordinary people just doing what they wanted in their own way. Plato, who wrote The Republic, actually said that the people were not capable or in a position to decide what should happen in government. Now, what he meant by that was ordinary people. Obviously, educated, tax-paying people like Plato and other nobles, they should decide what was going on, but not everybody. That would just create chaos and anarchy. Now, that's an important concept for those of you looking at America, because that's what influenced the understanding of democracy for the founding fathers when the American Constitution was written. It was democracy for the educated and the wealthy who understood things and, you know, could make sure society ran appropriately. It certainly wasn't the idea that everyone got a say, and in fact most of the founding fathers, like Washington, Jefferson, Madison, initially were quite opposed to the idea of ordinary people being able to have a say. And that's why the Senate has so many more powers than the House of Representatives, but that is perhaps for a future time. Clearly though, the ancient way, or the traditional way of looking at democracy, was that letting ordinary people decide would be a disaster. And that view persisted for about 2,000 years. And it wasn't really until about 300 years ago. Mainly in the UK, but coming through in France as well, that over the last 300 years, a compromise has emerged, which allows ordinary people a say, but doesn't allow them to run a country directly. And that is what we call representative democracy, whereby people choose someone, for want of a better term, a social better, to go and make decisions on them. But the people shouldn't decide for themselves, because, you know, people aren't clever enough to understand it. That was kind of the view that most people have taken of democracy 300 years ago. In the UK, the way the UK works now, the final political authority always resides with the people, and that comes through during elections. So any preferences for the will of the people must be taken into account. Obviously, if a political party or a politician ignores the people consistently, they will be voted out of office when it comes to an election. It's one of the reasons why, famously, the Labour Party got hammered in the 1983 general election, at a time when people were more inclined to privatisation and free market economics that Thatcher promised. The Labour Party was pushing for more socialistic policies, higher taxation and nationalisation of industries. But the key thing, so the Labour were fancying that, and in the end they got absolutely hammered in the polls. And what happened, eventually the party reconsidered and started adopting what the people wanted in the form of New Labour, and as a result they won elections. But the point with all of this is, in modern UK politics, or until very recently, the will of the people has to be taken into account, but it doesn't necessarily have to be obeyed. And that's the key thing with the representative democracy. You listen to the people, you try to acknowledge their concerns, but it doesn't mean you do everything the people want. However, institutions and practices exist to help translate the will of the people into sound and sensible government policies. And again, that's the idea. The people, you know, 70 million people in the UK, it's a sort of amorphous mass of people. How do you translate that into clear, simple, straightforward laws and policies? And who gets to decide what the will of the people is? And so, in order to inform the government and the political actors, we have political parties, we have pressure groups, we have parliament, and we have the law courts, who all try and translate this general principle of what the people generally want and what's best for them into clear, manageable tasks that will make society better for the most people. Why? Why do we need that? Well, those representative bodies, parties, pressure groups, etc., they're a way of dealing with all the differences of opinions that exist across the UK 70 million people. Obviously, they don't all agree very much, as we see on many issues. And those parties and pressure groups and parliament have to translate those into clear action. It's a practical way of translating ideas into action. It's a way of dealing with a lack of education or understanding that may exist. You know, pressure groups are specialists on key policy areas, and they can say, well, actually, if you try and do this, this will be the consequences, and that might be really bad for people. So they can translate aims and ideas into sound policy that will actually be effective rather than just popular. And also, these institutions are a way of protecting society from short-term populist views. You know, there might be a big eruption of support for one particular issue, but it's the parties, the pressure groups and parliament that, in theory, temper these down and just say, well, hang on, let's think about this and let's get it right. It's also, importantly, a way of protecting minorities from prejudice, and I don't just mean racial minorities, any minority interest otherwise gets protected as well. Otherwise, you know, the majority might like something or not like something and ban it, and that can impinge on a minority or their beliefs or their ways of doing things. So it's a way of making sure everyone gets considered. For example, smoking as an issue. Probably, although I haven't got any evidence for this, but a majority of UK people seem to be opposed to smoking and would like to see it reduced, and obviously there's practical reasons for that, but there are people that smoke and feel that their interests are being undermined and victimised, and there's a pressure group called Forest which acts on their behalf and tries to promote their rights. Now, you don't have to agree with that, but they're at least helping to represent their interests and make sure their views and their position is considered. So that's why having a representative democracy with these representative institutions is important. It makes things work. But why does it need to be translated? Well, think about these issues and just generally think what most people would vote for. If you were asked the question in a sort of direct democracy in a referendum, do you want to pay more tax? Most people would probably say no. If you're asked, do you want to have better services like healthcare and education? Again, most people would say, yeah, love that. And again, do you want the government to run up huge debts? Most people would say no. no, we don't want that to happen. The trouble with that is it doesn't add up. You know, you can't expect more to be provided for you, more healthcare, more education, but to pay less for it without the government borrowing huge amounts. And you might say, well, that's ridiculous, but that's actually happened in California, where the main system of taxation has been capped through a public vote because people didn't want to pay lots of tax on properties. That meant in order to maintain services, the government had to borrow a lot more, the state government of California. But people then didn't like that idea of California getting into debt, so they had a vote and said, you have to balance the budget, which meant the only option left to the government was to cut services. And again, people didn't like that, and they kept voting for more services. And that's why California's gone from being the wealthiest state in America to one of the poorest and into a huge financial crisis. Because what the people wanted doesn't translate into sound and sensible policy. So representatives have the task of translating all these ideas that the people really like into something that actually works in the real world and can be achieved. And that's what representative democracy should be about. So how does this work in practice? Well, in the UK, people will elect a representative from a geographic area called a constituency, will go off to a legislative chamber. We call that Parliament, the House of Commons. And at that chamber, they will make decisions on behalf of the people who elected them, the people they represent. So an MP from East Surrey will go off to represent the people of East Surrey. An MP from Maidenhead will go off to represent the people of Maidenhead. An MP from Newcastle will go off to represent the issues and concerns of people of Newcastle. And they will sit around and discuss ideas and policies with a view to how they might impact on their local constituencies. The representative is supposed to gather all the facts on a particular issue, think about those issues, you know, meaningfully, think about what the consequences will be, having investigated and looked at the information. They debate, they discuss in this legislative chamber the pros and cons of the proposed action, discuss that issue, and as a whole, through a vote, they reach a judgment on the policy, and they then write or formulate that policy and eventually bring it into law. That is how the legislative process, the lawmaking process works, and that is how all representative democracies effectively work. So the idea there is that while the people might want things, the representatives have to make it practical and do what you might hear a lot about, do what's in the national interest, what's best for people. If you think about it, I suppose with children, you know, a child might not like to eat their vegetables, but vegetables are good for them. Now, if you left it up to a child and said, right, do you want to eat your vegetables, yes or no, they'd probably say no. However, a parent would say, well, that's not good for you, therefore you have to eat them. And that's, in a sense, what politicians are supposed to do in a representative democracy. They have to say, look, I know you don't want to pay more tax, but it's what you have to do if you want a decent healthcare service. It might not be popular, but that's their job, and they're experts in it, or in theory they're experts who do it. So is that happening in the UK and in America and elsewhere in the world? Arguably no. And what's gone wrong seems to be that the representative institutions, political parties, pressure groups, Parliament in America, Congress, and their practices have been hijacked by what we call populist elitist groups. People who don't care about the national interest, they only want what's best for them. And it's very much about what's popular, not what's right. So if we look at the UK, for example, Farage and UKIP's campaign, I mean, Farage in particular is an elitist. I mean, he's from a wealthy background, privileged background. But UKIP and the campaign to leave the EU very much appealed to populism. And it wasn't famously, sorry, this wasn't Farage, it was Michael Gove, you know, the people have had enough of experts. You know, we don't like being told what we want to do. We don't like the EU, therefore we want to leave it, without necessarily considering the practical ramifications of it, or in many ways dismissing any arguments as just simply project fear or being wrong. The same's true in America, where Donald Trump, definitely an elitist, or an elite, a billionaire who managed to appeal to popular things, you know, the idea of making America great again, securing jobs, even though in practical senses it doesn't really work. And both of those are just two examples of people that promoted anger at the institutions and practices of representative democracy to achieve their own ends. Farage would keep attacking the Westminster establishment as this evil group, tying all the major parties existing together as being against the people. Trump attacked not only the Democrats, but attacked Congress, he attacked Washington, he attacked the Republican Party, and as we've seen, as president, attacks the media. If they say anything critical, it's fake news. And that's dangerous because you're undermining the processes. Rather than listening and formulating policy, you're just going with what you want. And what people want is not necessarily what's in the national interest. And so Trump and Farage both won, in a sense, by attacking the system, not from working within the system. And we've seen a growing trend of that. Arguably, Macron did something a bit similar in France, although we certainly had the Front National gaining in popularity there again by attacking the existing system. So what does all this mean? Well, since the Brexit vote, we've had situations that are popular but have acted against the national interest. Now, I know anyone who's listening to this who supports Brexit will be saying, oh no, it's Project Fear and everything else. However, there has been a clear economic decline. The progress has slowed, economic progress has slowed. The UK has done less well in relation to the EU and the US since the vote in 2016, which is clear evidence that the vote to leave the EU has caused an economic decline. It did cause a fall in the pound. There is clear evidence of that. Businesses have been more reluctant to invest in the UK and are holding off investing until Brexit's happened and they know what the deal is and all those sorts of things. And there has, and there certainly was in the years since, been a rise in racially motivated hate crimes, particularly against EU citizens that are living in the UK. So all of those things suggest that the Brexit vote and the government's blind following of this Brexit vote has acted against the national interest and undermined Parliament's role as a representative body to look after everyone. In the US, well, we've had threats of healthcare repeal, which, although just about survived, it was only when it was about to be repealed that people realised, oh, hang on, 40 million people will lose their healthcare coverage. That's not a good idea. Although at the moment it seems to have come through, tensions rose against North Korea, almost leading to potential armed nuclear conflict that just didn't need to be there as Trump wound up Kim Jong-un. He seems to be on similar issues with other states at the moment, tearing up various trade deals, threatening to tear up NAFTA. This morning, Trump said he wants to take America out of the World Trade Organization. All these things have a detrimental impact on the American economy. American soybean farmers are being hit at the moment because China's retaliating to Trump's trade tariffs by putting up their own trade tariffs on things that America exports to China. And this is bad for many Americans, and it's causing hardships. I mean, with Trump, everything seems to change every day, but obviously relations with Mexico and with Canada have deteriorated. Generally, American relations with the rest of the world have deteriorated, and that's caused all sorts of problems for America's position in the world. And he's got hostility with Congress, where his own party's acting against him. And it's proving very difficult for very many things to actually be achieved or get done, all of which acts against the American national interest. And that's the problem with this rise of populism. However, it would be wrong to blame Farage and Trump and other populists for all this. The reason why Farage and Trump were successful is because existing politicians ignored ordinary people. for a long time, people have been uncomfortable about immigration in the UK. They've been uncomfortable about the EU, and they've just been dismissed by the major party leaders as being irrational. Hillary Clinton dismissed a lot of the Trump supporters as a basket of deplorables, and ignored the very real concerns that those people have. Now, because the established politicians, like Clinton or Cameron or Ed Miliband, etc., because they were ignoring the will of the people and not acknowledging it and trying to ease it in some way, it allowed these populists to come through and say, hey, they're not listening to you, I'll listen to you, I'll give you what you want. And that's what's led to the rise of populism and nationalism in British and American politics in recent years. It's the same elitism and the same democratic problem, it's just less pronounced. Basically, if politicians ignore the will of the people for too long, the people will find an outlet through elections or through new political figures, new parties, new campaigns, and they'll express that opinion. And that will shape future politics. The other problem that we have in modern democracies is the fact that most elections come down to very simplistic choices. In the USA, your vote for president tends to be a yes or no. You know, do you want candidate A or candidate B? Well, if you don't really like either, there's not much of a choice there. As particularly as well in America, that a criticism for a long time was that actually both parties are pretty similar in policies. That's changed since 2010. In a referendum, your choice is usually yes or no to a particular question, and it ignores all the complexities and what people actually are voting for. They have to make an aggregate decision, whereas most people probably want a sort of middle or compromise issue. In many UK elections, there's no choice. A huge number of seats are safe. They will be won by the same party time and again. In fact, only about 100 seats across the whole of the UK out of 650 actually are genuinely competitive. And even where they are competitive, at best it's a choice between two parties on most occasions. So there's a lack of choice being offered to the voters. So they have to make a simplistic decision on a I like this or I don't like this basis. And those simplistic choices are motivated by what we call partisan interests. Labour will say what Labour needs to say to win. The Conservatives will say what they need to say to win. A lot of Republicans didn't like Trump or support his policies, but hey, he's the Republican candidate. We want Team Republican to win. So it becomes about winning rather than about doing what you believe or what you're doing about doing is right. And it's part of the problem with parties dominating the political system. You've also got the problem with who gets to vote and how votes are counted. So, for example, Trump lost the popular vote in America by 3 million. So if you add up all Americans, 3 million more Americans voted for Hillary Clinton than voted for Donald Trump. However, he had the right sorts of voters. He had key swing voters in swing states, and that did enough for him to win the political game. You've also got this issue in America of politicians drawing the districts, what we call gerrymandering. Effectively, the representatives are choosing their voters rather than the voters choosing their representatives. And that means they're choosing safe districts so they don't have to worry about being held accountable. And that undermines the principle of representative democracy. In the EU referendum, this is a major, major constitutional decision. In effect, it was made by 37% of all those who were given the right to vote. So obviously, they won. It was 52% of those that voted, but only about 72% of people turned out to vote. Maybe 77, sorry, I've got that wrong. But if you work it out, of all the people in the UK that could have voted, only 37% actually voted for something that's going to affect everyone. And of course, many people with valid interests in Britain being part of the EU or not being part of the EU were excluded. Under 18s didn't get a right to vote. Expats living in the EU weren't allowed the right to vote. People from elsewhere in the EU who were long-term residents in the UK working here for years weren't given a vote. So their views were ignored. And again, such an important decision, there's a feeling that this was made by just over a third of the population. In Scotland, 16 and 17-year-olds were allowed to vote. But again, the cynical reason there is because the SNP knew they'd be more likely to vote for independence. So quite often, it's not a question of what the people as a whole want. People are just playing a numbers game and trying to make sure they've got the right sort of voters in the right places to ensure their view wins or their team wins, rather than actually listening to what the people really want. You've also got a problem with social media coming through. So although Donald Trump tends to label everything as fake news that he doesn't like, there is a genuine problem there. There is fake news, and it's come through the increased use of social media. This undermines the idea of real knowledge and undermines difficult decisions. You know, if anything you don't like is dismissed as fake news, because there is quite a lot of fake news out there. And places like Breitbart don't have to be held accountable. People make statements on Twitter that just aren't necessarily true, but people come to believe that it's true. Donald Trump hears something on Twitter, he states it as if it's true, and then because the President of the United States has said it's true, a lot of other people believe it and then tweet it themselves or forward it in messages, and it becomes a truth. But it's not. It's based on no truth at all, but people believe it. A good one for that is sort of celebrity rumours, but that's for another time. There's also the problem with things like data techniques. Cambridge Analytical, which got into big trouble for the way it used data. Data companies keep gathering information and profile people so that they can target key voters. And again, if you're someone who a particular side wants to vote, you will get a huge amount of information. You'll be pressured, manipulated into trying to go out to vote. If you're not in the key demographic, you'll be ignored. And again, this isn't about politicians listening to the voters. It's about politicians choosing their voters. And that undermines the whole basis of representative democracy. Trump's campaign, for example, targeted Hillary Clinton's voters to undermine confidence in her so that they wouldn't go out and vote. They never tried to appeal to them. They knew Hillary supporters or Democrats weren't going to go and vote for Trump and the Republicans. So they just tried to say, well, Hillary's got no chance. Hillary's got all these problems. There's no point voting for her. And it seems to have worked. In key states, a number of Hillary voters didn't go over to Trump. They just didn't bother to vote. In the UK, traditionally, betting odds and betting shops have been seen as a good way of working out what's actually going to happen. And so people have taken advantage of that. So heavy betting was carried out on the Remain side to make people during the 2016 referendum, to make people think that it was going to be a foregone conclusion. And therefore Remainers said, oh, well, Remain's clearly going to win, therefore we don't need to go out and vote. Whereas actually they needed to. So again, it wasn't that people were making a bet on the outcome because they genuinely thought that's what the outcome would be to make money. They did it to try and influence people and make them and play psychological games to make them stay at home and not bother voting. And of course, we've got the whole thing at the moment with Twitter bots, which can make fake accounts, which drive up tweets and forward them and can make things look like more of an issue than they really are. One example of that was a number of Twitter bots tweeted the hashtag Hispanics for Trump. And Trump was then able to say, hey, look, there's this group, Hispanics for Trump, sort of millions of these people following me and supporting me and tweeting me. Therefore, I've got support. And people went, oh, yeah, Hispanics are clearly supporting Trump. But it was all fake. It wasn't a real group. It was all fake. But because these fake accounts had made it look like there was a group called Hispanics for Trump, Trump was able to say Hispanics support him. And the news reported that and believed it. But again, there's no truth to it. And that means that people are being manipulated into voting. There's also the issue of political bias to consider. The issues, and this is the real crux of the problem that democracy has at the moment. The issues aren't really with the results of the Trump election or the EU referendum, but how the results were achieved. And this has been the big shift over the last 10 years or so in Western democracies. It's not the politicians trying to get the people to vote for them by trying to listen to them, adhere to their policies or do something that's going to be popular. it's actually politicians manipulating the public into voting for what they want. And that is, that goes against democracy. That in itself is elitism. It's the politicians repeatedly, or a group of politicians, choosing, setting the agenda, choosing what they want to achieve, and then picking the voters to support their point of view, rather than listening to what the voters actually want. When representative democracy works at its best, it's messy and it takes time, but usually it's about politicians listening to what the public want and eventually adapting their policies to what the public support. I mentioned New Labour, the Labour Party at the start of this, and that kind of proves the point. The Labour Party had its principles, socialist principles, believed in nationalisation for a long time. But then they kept losing election after election after election because the British people as a whole no longer supported nationalisation. They generally were supporting privatisation. End result, the Labour Party changed its policy. It reacted to the public. Now, you can contrast that with the rise of Momentum, more traditional socialist faction of the Labour Party, who increasingly are trying to control politicians, who are trying to get rid of any Labour MPs who might not support their more nationalist, more strident agenda, and manipulate the voters in these processes. And that means Momentum is choosing Labour Party voters and Labour Party policy rather than listening to what the voters and the public want. All of this is why there are very real concerns for the future of democracy in the UK, and why democracy itself seems to be under attack. And these are kind of the issues you need to consider. Is democracy in trouble? Now, you might argue democracy has had these issues before. It had these issues during World War One, World War Two, the 1930s. There were crises in the 1960s, etc. And democracy always comes through. But the trouble and the problems we have now are seem to be greater. And there's a lot of work out there suggesting maybe this is the moment where democracy runs out of its ability to renew itself and adapt to these problems. Although maybe this is just a process, and in 5-10 years time, democracy will have come through this, and we'll be in a better place because of it. But there are clearly issues and problems that democracy has now. And being a student of politics, your job isn't to answer that or solve those problems, but to understand why those problems exist and how they might be solved. So I hope that's given you some food for thought. I would recommend a series of books by David Runciman, Cambridge professor, who's written various books about democracy, democracy in crisis. Well worth a read if you want to explore this a bit more. I'll come back to the idea of democracy and how it works at a future point. But I hope to speak to you again soon, and hope this has been useful. Thank you very much.